Imagine you have like $10 million in active loan files just sitting on your desk on a Friday afternoon. You know, you've done the work, the structures make total sense, your clients are absolutely ready to buy.
Everything is lined up perfectly.
Exactly, lined up perfectly. And then you open your laptop on Monday morning and the bank tells you they won't accept a single one of them.
Just brutal.
Right. The playbook you've relied on for years has just been entirely rewritten over the weekend. And nobody bothered to send you the memo. And the crazy thing is, that wasn't some hypothetical nightmare. That was the brutal reality that hit the Australian mortgage market in mid-May 2026.
It really was. I mean, it was an incredible structural shock to witness. We are talking about a fundamental shift in how capital is deployed. And it happened almost overnight.
Yeah.
It just left professionals across the entire property sector scrambling, you know, desperately trying to figure out how to salvage their active pipelines.
Which brings us to the core of today's deep dive. We are looking at this incredibly timely piece of reporting from the Broker Times. It was published on June 1st, 2026 by Jennifer Austin, and it's titled The Trust Lending Freeze Spreads.
It's a fantastic breakdown.
It really is.
Wow.
And we have a very clear mission for you today based on this article. First, we're going to uncover exactly why major lenders like Macquarie and First Max suddenly slammed the brakes on trust lending. Second, we'll map out this brand new, heavily fractured four-band lender landscape.
Which is amazing itself right now.
Oh, totally. And finally, we're just going to walk through a critical five-step decision tree so you can actually successfully navigate this new reality without losing your mind or your clients. Okay, let's unpack this. Before we figure out where to send a loan file right now, we really need to understand the underlying mechanics of why the market seized up. I mean, how did we get here?
Well, to understand the why, we have to look at a collision of three separate factors. I mean, this wasn't just, you know, one bank executive waking up on a Tuesday and deciding they didn't like trusts anymore.
Okay, but
first, we had this massive, completely unsustainable surge in concentration risk. Throughout 2024 and 2025, there was this intense, basically social media-driven hype around property acquisition structures.
Oh, the financial sugar rush.
Exactly. Suddenly, you had a massive influx of retail borrowers demanding complex trust-based setups, and that pushed the volume of these specialized loans well beyond historical norms.
Right. It was like you had these TikTok property gurus convincing everyone that they absolutely needed a complex discretionary family trust just to buy, like, a basic suburban duplex.
Yes, that everyone needs a trust era.
Yeah. So the banks are suddenly receiving thousands of applications that require an assessor to sit there and read a 50-page legal trust deed instead of just glancing at a standard 2-page payslip. I mean, the infrastructure simply wasn't built to process that level of complexity at a retail scale.
That is the exact mechanical failure right there. The system just choked on its own administrative weight. And, you know, that leads directly into the second factor, which is that compliance has become an absolute nightmare for these institutions.
In what way?
Well, we're talking specifically about the documentation required to prove beneficial ownership and to trace guarantor structures. This is all coming to a head right now because of AUSTRAC's July 1st, 2026, referral partner reforms.
Oh, right. The AML stuff.
Exactly. Those reforms drastically expand anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing obligations. So the lenders are looking at this fast approaching deadline. They're looking at the mountain of complex trust files and realizing their current vetting processes just will not hold up to regulatory scrutiny.
So you've got overloaded assessors and this looming regulatory hammer. But there's a third factor here too, right? The actual tax environment.
Yeah, the third piece of the puzzle. We are dealing with significant post-budget tax uncertainty regarding how negative gearing and capital gains tax, or CGT, will actually treat trust-held properties going forward.
Ah, so the actual benefits are up in the air.
Exactly. If the tax benefits of holding a property in a trust are potentially going to be reduced or even removed entirely, the financial viability of those loans changes drastically. So when you combine abnormal volume, impending regulatory overhauls, and structural tax uncertainty,
the banks panic.
Well, credit risk departments tend to pull the emergency brake.
Which perfectly explains the headlines we saw. Macquarie hits pause, First Mac tightens the screws.
What's fascinating here is how the different lenders framed their retreats to the market. Macquarie explicitly framed their pause on new home loans to trusts and companies as a compliance-driven necessity.
Okay, blaming the red tape.
Right. But First Mac, on the other hand, rolled out a policy update that was framed purely around risk, you know, tightening their trust-related serviceability requirements. But honestly, if you are the one sitting at the desk trying to place a loan, the aggregate effect on your day-to-day is exactly the same.
It's a no either way.
Exactly. Treating a trust file like a standard residential application will now just cost you weeks of delays and ultimately a rejection.
Because the overarching rules of the game have completely changed. Which means the lenders themselves have fractured into entirely different camps based on their risk appetite. So if the old playbook is useless, what does the playing field actually look like today?
Well, according to the source, the June 2026 lending panel has effectively synthesized into four distinct bands. And it is operationally vital to understand where a lender sits in this matrix before you even think about submitting a file.
Okay, let's go through them.
Let's start with band A. This is your open with broad appetite category. These are reliable, they have wider pricing, and relatively standard processes. You'll find Ordee Financial, Latrobe, and a few select specialist lenders operating here.
Okay, so band A is sort of the safe harbor. They will take the complex work, but I imagine it might cost your client a bit more in interest or fees for that privilege.
You definitely pay for the expertise, yeah.
Makes sense. So what about band B?
Band B is defined as open with conditions, and these are your moving targets. They are still actively writing trust loans, but they are managing their inward flow by introducing friction.
Like what kind of friction?
They are asking for additional documentation. They are lowering their loan-to-value ratio ceilings, which means the client needs a bigger deposit, and their policies are literally changing week to week. This includes lenders like Brighton, Pepper, and ME Bank, specifically for their corporate trustee files.
Wow, that sounds incredibly frustrating to navigate. A policy might work on Tuesday, but by Thursday, the bank drops the maximum loan amount because they just got too many applications.
It's a constant moving target.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the true roadblocks, band C.
The danger zone.
Yeah, band C is effectively closed. Macquarie sits here with their complete pause. First Mac is highly restricted here. They are routinely declining new trust applications based on guarantor or serviceability constraints. And importantly, this ban includes several major bank arms that have just quietly stopped pursuing trust channel volume altogether. They haven't issued a press release or anything.
They just make it impossible?
Exactly. They just make the process so difficult that brokers naturally stop sending them files.
A silent exit. Okay, and finally we have Band D.
Band D is bespoke. These are the major bank private channels. They remain open, but only for high net worth clients on a deeply relationship-driven, case-by-case basis.
So not for the average person?
Not at all. It requires massive deposits, cross-collateralization, and existing business ties. It is absolutely not a volume play.
You know, looking at how this is laid out, I actually have to push back a little on the article's own title. The headline screams about a freeze.
Yeah.
But here's where it gets really interesting. It's not actually a complete system-wide freeze.
No, it's not.
It's more like a heavy industrial sorting process. Trust lending isn't dead at all. It's just been ruthlessly segmented. But if that's the reality, how on earth are you supposed to figure out which band a specific client belongs in before you waste 3 weeks getting rejected?
That is the exact operational problem this article tries to solve. To avoid those cascading rejections, you can't just rely on intuition anymore. You have to use a highly structured filtering process.
The decision tree.
Exactly. The source introduces a brilliant operational tool, the five-step decision tree. This is where we transition from high-level market theory into practical, defensive application.
Okay, let's walk through the filter. If a client comes to me today with a trust structure, what is the very first thing I need to establish?
Decision one, is the structure actually essential or is it merely convenient?
Ah, okay.
This is where you weed out that lingering social media hype we talked about. You need to ask, is this trust required for legitimate asset protection, accountant-approved tax structuring, or legal requirements for a self-managed super fund?
Or is it just a trend?
Right. Did the client just hear a podcast claiming rich people use trusts? So they set one up for a basic investment property. If it's merely convenient, the most efficient move you can make is to pivot the client to a standard personal name purchase.
I love this step because it forces a reality check. If the goal is just to buy a simple property, keeping the complex trust is like buying a massive diesel-powered commercial tractor just to mow a tiny suburban lawn.
That is a perfect analogy.
Right. It is fundamentally over-engineered for the job. And right now, going the personal name route for those convenient files just strips away the friction. It's faster, it's cheaper, and it actually gets the deal funded.
It simplifies the legal architecture instantly. But, you know, if the accountant insists the trust is essential, then you move to decision two. What is the specific structure type?
Because they aren't all treated the same.
Exactly. Not all trusts are viewed equally by credit assessors right now. Self-managed super funds, or SMSFs, have their own highly regulated, dedicated policy track. Specialist lenders like Liberty, Granite, and La Trobe are still reliably open for those because the rules are rigid and clear.
Right.
Discretionary family trusts, however, are facing massive line-by-line scrutiny.
What exactly are the assessors looking for when they scrutinize a family trust like that?
They are digging deep into the legal mechanics. They are checking vesting dates, which is essentially the legal expiration date when the trust is forced to dissolve and distribute its assets.
Oh.
They are scrutinizing the settlors, the person who handed over the original nominal sum to legally create the trust, to ensure there are no hidden beneficial owners. I mean, it's forensic work at this point.
Wow. What about hybrid or unit trusts? Where do they sit in this landscape?
Oh, they are the hardest to place by a wide margin. Most major banks won't touch them right now because the overlapping beneficial ownership structures are just incredibly difficult to untangle for anti-money laundering purposes.
So if I strip away the convenience factor and verify the client actually needs this structure, and I know exactly what kind of architectural box we are playing in, I imagine the next major roadblock is the human element. Because loans aren't paid back by legal documents. They are paid back by people.
Exactly. And that brings us to decision three, which is the single biggest variable in this entire landscape, the guarantors.
Okay. How does this work?
This specific metric is what caused First Mac to tighten their policies. If you have a clean structure, for example, a corporate trustee with just one single personal guarantor backing the loan, you are in a highly placeable position.
Nice and simple.
Yeah. But if you have a complex structure like multiple directors, multiple beneficiaries, and multiple personal guarantors, you are going to hit a brick wall.
But wait, why the sudden hostility toward multiple guarantors? You would think the bank would want more people on the hook for the debt, not fewer.
You would think so, right? That used to be the logic. But the mechanics of how lenders assess mathematical risk have fundamentally changed. Lenders are now assessing serviceability against the full loan amount for all guarantors individually. They are stripping away the structural leverage that trust files use to provide.
Wait, I need to make sure I'm understanding the math on this. If a husband, a wife, and an adult son are all guarantors on a $1 million trust loan, the bank assesses the application as if each of those three people needs to afford a $1 million loan entirely by themselves. That's treating it like $3 million of aggregate debt.
It breaks the mathematical model entirely. It is like demanding three independent backup parachutes for one skydiver.
I'm messy.
The bank is essentially forcing every individual guarantor to prove they could carry the entire weight of the loan independently. For most families, the math is instantly disqualifying.
That is absolutely brutal. No wonder the system seized up. Okay, assuming by some miracle the client survives that guarantor math, what is decision four?
Decision four. What is the underlying borrowing purpose? Owner-occupier trust purchases have an incredibly narrow window right now, mostly restricted to those high-net-worth bespoke channels we talked about.
Bandy.
Right. Investor loans have a slightly wider window, but as we've discussed, the conditions are tightening. And if your client wants to do a construction loan through a trust, that is basically paused or entirely impractical across the board.
I can see why.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a construction loan already requires multiple drawdowns, progress inspections, and builder checks. Trying to run that highly administrative process through a heavily scrutinized trust structure sounds like a complete paperwork nightmare.
It's just too many moving parts.
Which leaves us with the final filter, decision five, time frame.
Time frame is critical for managing client expectations right now. Turnaround times for trust files have blown out by 5 to 15 business days across the entire active panel.
Just to get an answer.
Right. A credit assessor simply needs more hours in the day to read these complex files. So if your client is signing a property contract with a standard 30-day finance clause, that is a highly dangerous proposition. You need to be having conversations with the real estate agent and the client about securing realistic extensions from day one.
So making the right tactical decision using that five-step tree is clearly crucial for getting the loan approved. But as I'm looking through the second half of this article, it seems like the actual documenting of that decision process is what keeps you out of a courtroom.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's transition into the compliance and operational survival side of this, because the red tape looks incredibly thick.
It is. And the required operational steps outlined by the source need to happen immediately. First, you must audit all of your active files. If you have a file currently sitting in the queue with a Band C lender like Macquarie, do not sit on your hands waiting for the inevitable decline email.
You have to move.
You need to proactively lodge a parallel application with a Band A or Band B lender right now to protect the client's timeline.
Right. You have to be proactive, not reactive. What about the way these files are actually submitted? Are we doing anything differently there?
Yes. You need to build a standardized one-page briefing template for your processing team. Do not just send a raw, unstructured file to the bank and expect the assessor to figure it out.
They'll just toss it.
Exactly. You need a cover sheet that includes the trust deed with the vesting date and beneficiary class clearly highlighted. You need the corporate trustee constitution, a clear, simplified guarantor schedule, proof of beneficiary income, and 2 full years of ATO trust tax records.
Wow, all up front.
If you send a file missing even one of those elements, it gets bounced back, and your service level agreement clock, or essentially your place in the processing line, resets to zero. You go straight back to the back of a 3-week line.
Ouch. And then there is the best interest duty, or BID, risk. The article flags this as a massive compliance trapdoor.
It is arguably the biggest legal exposure for brokers right now. The regulatory body, ASIC, is watching structural recommendations incredibly closely. Let's go back to our decision one scenario, where you advise a client that their trust is just convenient and suggest they pivot to buying the property in their personal name.
The tractor analogy.
Right. You cannot just casually make that suggestion over a quick phone call.
Because if you do, and you don't document it, you've essentially just given unlicensed financial advice. And if that client gets hit with a massive capital gains tax bill 5 years down the road, because they aren't in a trust, they're going to point the finger straight at you.
You own all the legal liability for that advice. You must capture the precise rationale for the switch, outline the alternative structures you considered, detail the different lender options available under each scenario, and clearly document the client's informed consent to make the change right there in your BD file notes.
So if you influence the legal architecture, you own the compliance on that architecture.
And this raises an important question. What happens when the OSTRAC July 1st, 2026 reforms fully kick in? Brokers are going to have expanded anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing obligations just for referring trust-structured business.
Just for the referral.
Yes. If you do not refresh your AML-CTF compliance protocols before accepting these files in the second half of the year, you are risking severe regulatory penalties and massive fines.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
Mm-hmm.
If I had to synthesize this heavy compliance section into a core takeaway, it basically boils down to this. Mm-hmm. Last year's lender is not this year's lender. The policies surrounding trusts are the most dynamic, volatile track in residential lending right now. Assuming your old habits, your old panel preferences, and your old casual documentation standards will work in mid-2026 is a massive blind spot that will completely wreck your pipeline.
It will bring your business to a grinding halt. And I know mapping out all of this regulatory friction, the math changes, and the legal jeopardy sounds incredibly daunting.
It really does. It sounds like a migraine waiting to happen. Is there an actual upside for the professional who is willing to put in the grueling work to master this new landscape?
There is a tremendous commercial upside. Because the lazy volume is gone, trust lending has evolved from a standard transaction into a highly profitable specialist channel.
Okay, I see where this is going.
The generalists are actively fleeing this space because the friction is just too high. They are literally leaving money on the table.
So the extreme difficulty of the process actually becomes your competitive advantage.
Exactly. Brokers who truly master the current panel matrix, who enforce deep documentation discipline with that one-page briefing template, and who actively build out specific referral networks, they are going to command a smaller but much stickier and significantly higher converting pipeline.
The source actually mentions building a very specific type of network to survive this. It recommends partnering with 2 property law solicitors and 1 trust specialist accountant. Why that specific mix of professionals?
Because many files are actually slowed down by poor quality trust deeds, not just lender policy. A lot of clients are using off-the-shelf trust templates from 2010 that simply do not hold up to 2026 banking scrutiny.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so if you can route a client to a trusted solicitor to review and legally amend a deed before you submit it to the bank, you save weeks of back and forth. Furthermore, Property accountants and family lawyers are absolutely desperate for brokers who understand this new landscape.
Because they're the ones fielding angry phone calls from clients who suddenly can't get finance, and the accountants need a reliable release valve.
Yes, exactly. They have no one to send these complex files to. The article explicitly notes that a single 30-minute introductory coffee meeting with a specialized accountant right now can yield 3 to 5 high-quality, pre-vetted trust files over the next 6 months.
That is an incredible return on investment for a 30-minute coffee.
It really is. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this intense tightening we are experiencing isn't a permanent door closing on the industry. It is a filtration system. It is violently separating the true specialists from the generalists. The major lenders that are currently paused will eventually reopen once they solve their internal compliance bottlenecks.
It's just a matter of time.
Right. And when they do, the professionals who have maintained their expertise, navigated the friction, and built a database of waiting clients are going to capitalize on massive volume the second the policy loosens.
They will be positioned perfectly to catch the wave while everyone else is still trying to figure out what happened to the old rules. Man, we've covered a huge amount of vital ground today.
To summarize, trust lending in mid-2026 requires a highly structured, deeply defensible operational process. If you treat a complex trust file like a standard residential application, you are just going to be apologizing to your clients for endless finance clause extensions and eventual declines.
You have to use the 5-step decision tree to filter the noise. You must audit your lender panel constantly. You need to build that 1-page briefing template to protect your place in line. And you must meticulously document your best interests, duty position to protect yourself legally.
It is entirely about adapting to the new environment rather than wasting energy wishing the environment hadn't changed. But before we wrap up today, there is one final unmentioned ripple effect of all this regulatory friction that is absolutely worth pondering.
Oh, I love these broader implications. Lay it on us.
Well, if this intense regulatory and compliance squeeze on trust lending isn't just a temporary 6-month blip, I mean, if this extreme level of mathematical friction and required documentation becomes the permanent new normal for the Australian market, will we eventually see a mass unwinding or sell-off of existing trust-held properties by frustrated investors who simply find it mathematically impossible to refinance their current debt? And if we do see a mass exodus of investors abandoning these structures, what kind of shockwave would that sudden influx of inventory send through the broader Australian housing supply?
Man, now that is a terrifying domino effect. If the structural leverage that made these investments attractive is permanently gone, maybe the asset goes with it. That is something you'll definitely want to keep a close eye on as these AUSTRAC reforms roll out. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep exploring, and remember, just because the old playbook got thrown out the window doesn't mean you can't write a much more profitable one. See you next time.